During the last debate, Senator Marco Rubio said our country doesn't need more philosophers, we need more plumbers. Scott Samuelson believes most plumbers could benefit from a good class on philosophy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Scott Samuelson teaches philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's the author of the book The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone, and he just received the prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. I'll talk with him about why he has dedicated his career to teaching philosophy at a community college and why he firmly believes that philosophy is for all of us. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Philosophy majors may not get a lot of respect from the general public, but most members of the public dabble in philosophy from time to time, whether we know it or not. Scott Samuelson fell in love with the study of philosophy a long time ago, and much to his surprise, he found that he loves to teach people who are unlikely students of philosophy. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's the author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone, and he just received the very prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. He is in the studio with me today. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. I'm a big fan of Talk of Iowa.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and it's so great to have you here. I want to go back to when your interest in philosophy started, and you write in the introduction of your book about really the first time that you feel you started asking philosophical questions, although it predates your introduction to the formal study of philosophy. You write about when you were a teenager hanging out with a friend. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, are you thinking of the time when I was kissing a pillow?
That time, yep.
Okay. Well, yes, I was quite young, and it's a little bit of an embarrassing moment, actually. You're starting off the interview putting me on the spot here. But, yeah, I was with a friend, and the embarrassing part was that we were practicing kissing on pillows somehow. But I had a very peculiar experience while I was doing this where all of a sudden I felt this sort of dizzying sense of why does anything exist? Why am I here? Why, you know, am I kissing a pillow? Who am I? In fact, the thing that was really amazing was later when I did begin to study philosophy 10 years, 12 years later, I was reading in a great philosopher, Martin Heidegger's book, about how one of the fundamental questions of philosophy is why is there being rather than nothing? And indeed, that was basically what I was wondering about even as that little kid. And it felt like a very dizzying, scary experience. And when I came to, I turned to my friend and I tried to express it to him. And he said to me in a very nonchalant way, oh, yeah, I've felt that before too. So I guess that in a way launched me on my career in philosophy, that those strange moments of wonder that we have are something that, in fact, are shared more widely than we sometimes
right.
think.
I think almost all of us probably can relate to that feeling just of, oh, what's going on? Why am I here? What is the meaning of
all
of this?
Well, yeah, and even sometimes less profound questions but still really puzzling ones. Another one that I remember when I was a kid, I used to really puzzle about the question of, do I see the same color blue as everyone else? And I would think, you know, maybe what I'm calling blue is what other people call yellow, and we've got our wires crossed, and how can I know that? But I was too afraid to tell anyone because I thought, oh, they'll think I'm crazy that, you know, I'm seeing a different color blue. But then again, later on, I was reading great philosopher John Locke, and he builds a big part of his philosophy on the very question of do we see the same colors as everyone else? And so ever since then, I've kind of realized, well, if I bring up these kinds of moments of wonderment, I find often people do wonder if they see the same color blue as everyone else.
So when was the first time you picked up a book of philosophy?
Well, I was about 16 years old, and I believe it was in the Iowa City Public Library. I grew up in a town just a little south of Iowa City, and I chanced on in the book, it said Thomas Aquinas' Five Proofs of God. And I was just floored by the idea that there was someone trying to prove the existence of God. So I read the proofs, and I wish I could say that I understood them as a 16-year-old, but I did not. However, somehow as I was reading these proofs, I felt like that whatever Thomas Aquinas was doing was the best thing a human being could do, the most interesting, greatest thing that the human brain could be put to. And so even though I didn't really understand what he was doing, I wanted to do what he was doing. So I began to read more philosophy, and then I went on to study it, and the rest is history.
Where did you turn after that? I mean, what was the first philosopher that you read that you actually understood?
Well, like a lot of kids around that age who are interested in philosophy, I immediately turned to the existentialists. And I was particularly fond of Albert Camus. What was one of the things that was so great about the existentialists and someone like Camus is not only did he write philosophical essays, but he wrote novels as well. And so I really got into philosophy in that way in which philosophical thinking and stories were all mixed together. And I have to say I don't know that I've ever fully left that behind. I still like a certain amount of storytelling being attached to philosophy. We sometimes understand things better through a story than we do through just an abstract presentation. I wanted both, but I like the stories being part of it.
So as you went on and decided to study philosophy, you went to Grinnell for your undergrad. What did you think you would do with the study of philosophy?
Yeah, you know, I sort of blame my parents up to a point for never hitting me upside the head and saying, "What are you doing studying philosophy?" They didn't
I
really.
I think they probably called that being supportive.
Well, yeah, maybe. And I do think at some point they sat me down and said, "Well, I don't know. What are you thinking of doing with this, Scott?" But, you know, I have to say, when I went to Grinnell, I'm so grateful to the fact that I started studying philosophy. I was not thinking about what am I going to do with this. I was just thinking, this is a great thing to study. I come alive when I'm studying it. My mind is on fire. I'm learning all this stuff. And so at first it just seemed to me like just a great thing to do and a great thing to study. And I'm grateful for that kind of break from the worries of what are you going to do. I'm kind of the mind that when we get a real education, the rest will take care of itself, that we will be able to find good work and we'll be able to make a good contribution to society. But if all we do is focus on what's going to immediately advance me, sometimes we don't even really advance ourselves all that well. So anyway, I mean, I wasn't originally concerned with what am I going to do with this. But when I did start to think about what am I going to do with philosophy, I wanted to teach.
As you pursued your PhD, I can imagine most of the other people who were pursuing their PhDs were thinking about, you know, working at a university, possibly finding one of those beautiful tenure-track positions, although they're harder and harder to come by. As you went along, what made you land at Kirkwood Community College? Tell me about the path that you took there.
Yeah. I wish I could say that I came purely for noble reasons at first. I was very interested in teaching at a community college, but it was mainly because I found myself all of a sudden desperately in need of health insurance and some money. And I did want to come back to Iowa. I did my graduate work in Atlanta, Georgia at Emory University. And a job opened up at Kirkwood and I applied and I got it and I was very grateful. And part of me thought, well, you know, maybe I was still finishing my dissertation. Maybe I'll just use this as a springboard to something else. But what I found teaching at Kirkwood was that I just really loved it. I loved having students from all over the world. I loved having students from all walks of life. I liked having students that we sometimes refer to as non-traditional students, students who've had a lot more life experiences than even, you know, a clever 18 or 19-year-old can ever have, and hence brought much more to the table when it came to talking about philosophy. So I came to Kirkwood, you know, just happy to have a job. But then I really realized that it was a kind of destiny for me there.
Now, most philosophy professors don't spend all of their time teaching philosophy majors because intro to philosophy is for a lot of people as far as they go. And so what would you say is different about teaching philosophy at a community college versus teaching an intro to philosophy class at a larger university?
Yeah. Well, I hope that the teaching of it actually isn't so different, though maybe it is at times, because my view really is philosophy is beneficial for all people. And so, you know, I think if you can get the best possible philosophical education and put it into someone's hands, that's going to be the best thing. But what is different is that at a community college, you're more likely to have people who have had really serious life experiences that can be brought to bear on the subjects that are being discussed. I could give you many, many examples of this kind of thing. Let me just give you one or two. I was once talking about a point in the great philosopher Immanuel Kant's moral philosophy, where he claims that the moral worth of an action is located solely in the motive of the action. In other words, we should do the right thing for the right reason, and it's doing it for the right reason that makes it right. You might think of our Good Samaritan laws, where even if something bad happens and the consequences are quite severe, that if you're trying to save someone's life, we don't hold you morally culpable. So we were talking about this idea in class, and one of my students was a middle-aged woman who had had a child who was crippled, and she was forced to authorize a surgery for this kid, for her son, that was a little bit risky. And she did it trying to do the right thing, but the consequences were such that her son ended up dying from the mm-hmm. surgery. So when she approached Kant, she was asking with tears in her eyes if Kant was right that the consequences of the action play no role in its moral worth. Now, that's an important question for everyone, but when you bring that kind of experience to that question, it really deepens it and reminds us that these are matters of life and death and matters of our own worth as human beings.
That really play into our day-to-day experience
right.
as well. What makes a student take your class? What brings them there?
Well, I don't know. I suppose lots of reasons. Sometimes it's just simply that it's conveniently scheduled. I also think the great thing about philosophy is sometimes people who take a philosophy class, they do have some kind of little spark in them of, I want to learn a little bit more about this. I'm interested in what this is all about. So I often get some pretty curious, wonderful students on that score. But like I said, I get some of them who just end up there because it's conveniently scheduled. Some of those students have turned out to be some of my best students, though, so I'm not going to put that down.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Scott Samuelson. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. And he just received the prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Scott Samuelson. He is a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. And he just received the prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. And I want to ask you, Scott, because as we've talked about, a lot of us explore philosophical questions, whether we would frame it that way or not, you know, when we're deciding what we want to dedicate our careers to or even making parenting decisions, all kinds of things that really are themes that have been explored by the great philosophers over time. Why do you feel it's useful to go back to those great philosophers when you're exploring these questions as opposed to just exploring the question?
Well, I want to have both. I think it's utterly crucial that we explore the questions ourselves. That's part of the beauty of philosophy. The word itself, philosophy, is an ancient Greek word, a compound word that basically just means the love of wisdom. And what I love about that etymology is that I would emphasize the love part, that in philosophy, it's not just that we claim to have a bunch of wisdom and that we're going to give it to you. Of course, many institutions in our society do claim that, politics, the law, religion, self-help books. They say we have wisdom and here it is. And sometimes that wisdom is quite good. But what philosophy is all about is the search for wisdom, the love of wisdom, the trying to find wisdom for yourself. So it's definitely important for us to explore these things on our own. But when we look to the great tradition of the past, what we find is this is the best that we have to help us find wisdom. These are people who truly have loved wisdom and sought it out. And we often find that the shape of our own thoughts runs parallel or in the grooves of their thoughts, only they've perhaps taken it further or taken it to dimensions that we haven't yet been able to consider. So in reading the great philosophers, it expands us. It takes the thoughts that we have had and makes them bigger and better, and then it exposes us to thoughts that we perhaps never would have had that open up new vistas for us altogether.
I think about you spend a lot of time in your book and clearly in your classes as well talking about Socrates and his search for wisdom. And, you know, I think about my life. I think about his life. And there are so few parallels. Our lives are extraordinarily different. But you tell a story about one of your students that really, without planning to, sort of reenacted Socrates' search for wisdom. Could you tell us that story? I think it really, really encapsulates how relevant that can be for someone today.
Yeah, I do too. And I love the story because it makes that connection between our everyday lives and what philosophy is all about, particularly philosophy is exemplified by Socrates. There's a very famous story about Socrates where the Delphic Oracle says that he's the wisest of all people. And when he catches wind of this, he doesn't believe it. He says, I can't be the wisest because I have no wisdom at all. I have no knowledge. So he sets out on a mission to disprove this oracle. And he goes around to the luminaries of Athens, questioning them about the special truths they claim to possess. And what he finds is that they often claim to have wisdom when they do not. And hence he says, I am the wisest, not because I have any great wisdom, but because I know nothing. And it's a puzzling story in a lot of ways. And it's interesting that a student helped me to understand this story, and a student who didn't have really much familiarity with Socrates, but she ended up going on a very similar Socratic quest and reenacting that story in some ways. Her name was Jillian, a really great lady. She was a nurse's aide when I had her in my class. And at one point I asked the class, what is the point of a hospital? What's a hospital for? Well, she's worked as a nurse's aide, so she thought she kind of knew, and so did everyone else in the class. But I challenged their answers, Socratic-like, to make them feel that maybe they didn't have as clear a sense as they thought they did. And after our discussion, Jillian was puzzled because she thought she should know as a nurse's aide what a hospital was all about. And she asked if she could write on this subject, and I encouraged her to. So what she did was she decided to go around the hospital asking the various luminaries in that hospital, what is the point of a hospital? She asked the doctors, the administrators, the patients, the nurses. She thought, well, surely someone has a pretty good sense of this. We have this huge institution. Someone must know. I don't. But what she found, much like Socrates, was that they gave the same kind of pat answers that we had shown to be inadequate, and she could shoot them down.
Which I have to say, she sounds like a very brave woman.
She was. She's a passionate, great lady in
right.
a
well,
lot
here,
of ways.
I want to pursue my career with you, and I will shoot down what you're saying.
Well,
about
I know,
why
and
we do.
Some, I think some doctors were a little put off by the fact that a nurse's aide was challenging their claims about the point of a hospital. And she said to me, just imagine here are people who have devoted their whole lives to studying medicine, but they haven't necessarily given much thought to why they're doing it. And she wasn't claiming that they did a bad job necessarily, but she thought that perhaps people would be better off if they opened their minds to the real meaning of what they were doing. She was echoing a famous claim from Socrates through Plato. The unexamined life is not worth living, or at least the idea that an examined life makes our lives more worth meaning living. But anyway, she eventually came to her own kind of view based on some readings that she'd done and conversations she'd had. She came to the idea that perhaps what a hospital was all about was to be there for people, to be there when they're sick, to be there when they're dying, to be there when they're mourning. Doctors, she concluded, were there to help the nurses, which I thought was just a marvelous idea of what a hospital is all about. Now, she said, maybe I'm not 100% right, but she was clear that this kind of search opened her up to the real value of what she was studying to do. And to me, it really illuminated what philosophy can be all about, and illuminated that story of Socrates, that his claim of ignorance and his pursuit of wisdom really helped to help to give him a much more meaningful life, just as Jillian's pursuit of meaning about what she was doing helped to plug her into it and to see its real value.
And did she feel that that changed how she felt about the job she was doing or hoping to do as she continued her education?
Well, I think she felt like it deepened what she was doing, that she had maybe some intuitive sense of it before, and now she felt like she was more connected to it. I got a chance to talk briefly with her not too long ago, and I asked her about that journey that she had gone on, and she said that she kept that paper she had written for me, and she'd still define her goals more or less in those terms.
Interesting. I'm talking with Scott Samuelson. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's also the author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we've got a number of people on the line who'd like to talk with you. Scott, Mark is up first in Des Moines. Hi, Mark.
Yes, hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, as a background, I'm 67 years old. And through life, this has just been brought up on one of your shows about a lack of skill we have in certain trades.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take philosophy as a trade that we're running short of. We have technology today that is running wild. But it seems it is running faster than our social skills to be able to use it effectively. And philosophers are not somebody that can take a college 101 course in philosophy. It takes those trainings, and then it takes years of gathering what they call wisdom, which is patting the face of the earth with your feet. And it seems like to me that this is a time that these things ought to be taken seriously to train people as our technology keeps getting worse, or I mean better and better and better, and we get worse and worse and worse at dealing with it. And you can see that in society as it goes on, including our political debates. That's just a comment that I'd like to get some feedback from you on.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for joining the conversation. Scott?
Well, yeah, I think that Mark is on to something important when it comes to things like technology or really any number of other things in life. It's easy to allow them to get in the driver's seat for us, that they seem to dictate what our lives are going to do. And it is crucially important that an education helps us to step back from all that and ask, well, what really is the value of this stuff? I often have my students think a little bit about what the technologies they're using do to them and do to their lives, and you know, to what extent is it aiding them, and to what extent is it deforming them? And that, to me, is part of the beauty of an education, is not just to teach us how to use technology, but to teach us what to think about it and how to use it properly, how to use it in ways that enhance our lives. But that's true of all things. It's true of politics. It's true of religion. These things can sometimes be the most beautiful things in the world. They can sometimes also really lead us astray. And part of what the beauty of philosophy is just to help us to step back and say, okay, when are these things really helping and when are they not?
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And he mentioned the world of politics, and I mentioned earlier that philosophy majors may not get a lot of respect in the general public. And Senator Marco Rubio had a comment. I misquoted it a little bit earlier, but let's listen to what he said during the Republican debate that took place earlier this week.
And make higher education faster and easier to access, especially vocational training. For the life of me, I don't know why we have stigmatized vocational education. Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers.
All right. That's Senator Marco Rubio from the Republican debate. And when you heard that, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I find it very depressing, to be honest. First of all, I don't know of any great stigmatization of education in the trades, and I certainly I don't have it. I very much admire trade education. In fact, if anything, I agree with Marco Rubio in the sense that I would like to see a certain kind of education in the trades enhanced. I don't see why even in high school you can't graduate both knowing something and being able to do something. But what I really didn't like about it was pitting welders against philosophers. In my experience, welders and philosophers can go quite nicely together, and I've known some welders who are interesting philosophers. I see this country as one of the great things about it is it was built by basically farmers who read Cicero. And there's a famous speech that was a kind of foundational speech for the community college given by Bud Jensen in the 60s where he got up and said, you know, these are the hands of a bricklayer. He was talking about his own hands. He says they're calloused. But he says, would you deny them the right to caress a volume of poetry? That seems to me to be the America that I really love and believe in, that a bricklayer is going to read poetry and that a farmer is going to read Cicero and that a welder can study philosophy. And I feel like if we invest in an education that is a broad education for everyone, that's going to empower us in any number of ways. It's going to make our welders have more meaningful lives, be better citizens. It's going to make our politicians be more understanding of the kind of debates that our country faces. So, you know, I just don't like that separation of thinking that there's the plumbers and there's the philosophers and that they're separate. In fact, in some ways, I almost find Rubio's comments to be irritatingly elitist, that somehow certain people are just cut out to be welders and others are cut out to be something more.
Well, that is an interesting point because I think that we have an idea, especially in this day and age, that the study of philosophy is something that is sort of an elitist pursuit. And if you look through history, there are many philosophers who, you know, published many books who were members of that mm-hmm. elite class. And they had the privilege of sitting around and thinking mm-hmm. and being in these great salons and talking about these big problems of life or big questions of life. Do you feel like there was sort of a sweet spot somewhere in between where philosophy was more egalitarian and more approachable to everyone?
Well, I think there have been various sweet spots. First of all, I would say that you're certainly right that that philosophy's often benefited from having the kind of leisure that comes with an elite status. But there have been many great philosophers who have come from non-elite backgrounds. Socrates among them. He came from working class backgrounds. His father was a stonemason. His mother was a midwife. Or the great philosopher Epictetus, who was a slave, in fact. So philosophy is always drawn on people from all across the spectrum of life. But I do think in ancient Rome and ancient Greece even, philosophy really at times was committed to being something that anyone could access. The social structures of Rome and Greece were such, though, that you know, basically that meant mostly men and mostly landowning men. The beauty of America and the promise of America is to say, hey, we can have those great goods that the ancient Greeks and Romans believed in, but let's spread them to everyone. So, I'm hoping that the sweet spot is one that we're always working towards, that where we're making philosophy and the goods that were once given only to the elites, we're giving it to everyone.
William is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, William.
Good morning. Enjoy your show. Enjoy professors' ideas. If on our computer we have a delete key and all the books of philosophy, if they were deleted, four words would suffice. Be good, do good. You need no other philosophy. I'd like his comment on that.
All right, William, thanks for your call. Scott?
Well, I'm just in shock about the idea of everything being deleted all of a sudden. This would be horrible to me. There's such humanity and richness in all those works. Though I will say, as summaries go, philosophy would certainly like the idea that one should try to be good and to do good. But part of what all of those great works of philosophy are about is trying to understand, well, what exactly does that mean? Sometimes what we assume to be good is good, and sometimes what we assume to be good is not so good. And the beauty of philosophy is that pursuit of trying to figure out the times when what passes as good is perhaps not so good.
Now, part of your job as a teacher is not just to introduce your students to these works and help them understand them, but also to ask questions. Do you find that students try to pin you down a lot on what you actually believe?
Oh, yeah. They always – it's inevitable that at some point during the semester, students start coming up to me and saying, so what really do you believe about this? And I always like to say – I like to keep a little bit of mystery surrounding me about these things, because you know I appreciate that they think I'm someone who's thought a lot about these matters, and they seek out my opinion, and sometimes I'm willing to give it to them. But what I don't want is for them to feel like I'm just handing down a belief to them from on high. Here, I want them to be the ones looking and searching. So I like that little bit of mystery that comes in philosophy.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Scott Samuelson. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's also author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. And he recently received the prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. We'll come back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Scott Samuelson, and we're talking about philosophy this hour. He's a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He's author of the book, The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to Robert next in Aquaca, Illinois. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be quick.
All right.
I graduated college in 1980, but I never took a philosophy course, but I've always liked to dabble in it. This summer, I finally finished Immanuel Kant's Prolegomena, Any Future Metaphysics, and it wasn't too bad. But I'm having trouble with Martin Heidegger. I find him very dense and almost unreadable. And also, since I don't know German, how do you pronounce Dasein or Dasein, which is a word that he uses? And also, what does he think, I mean, your guest, what does he think of Henry Bergson's work? I never hear much about him.
Well,
he's a favorite of mine.
First of all, it's the pronunciation is Dasein, and it's Heidegger's way of just talking about human existence in some ways. The German word just means being there. And so, I mentioned that I was into the existentialists earlier, and Heidegger was a really great influence on the existentialists in some ways. But I share your feeling. Heidegger can be real hard going, but if you've handled Kant's Prolegomena, you're well on your way to doing well. Henri Bergson is another just wonderful philosopher and beautiful writer. So I would encourage you to keep reading. He's one of the great treasures of French philosophy.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for your call. And for people who maybe they never took a philosophy course in college, or maybe they didn't appreciate it when they did, how do you get started if you're thinking, I would like to explore some of these great philosophers? Where would you begin?
Well, I wrote my book, The Deepest Human Life, as my attempt to kind of open the doors of the philosophical tradition as wide as I can. And so, you know, in that book, I start with the dialogues of Plato about Socrates. There's a famous collection of those dialogues called The Last Days of Socrates that I think is just second to none as an introduction to philosophy. What's so amazing is even though Plato was writing 2,400 years ago, his words still speak right to us, and there's a kind of directness to them. I find my students often respond better to Plato than they do if I assign them, you know, an article from the recent New Yorker. There's something just direct about those great dialogues. But I chart out some other figures as well in my book that I think are useful guides to the great history of Western philosophy. Of course, there are other great traditions than the Western tradition. I'm a big fan of Chinese philosophy as well. And so just as I like starting with Plato in the Western philosophical tradition, Confucius is a wonderful philosopher to start with in the Chinese philosophical tradition.
Well, and that dovetails with a question from Travis in Fairfield. Hi, Travis.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
So he just started to address it. I was wondering in what ways in his book or in his courses that he combats the somewhat apt characterization of philosophy as just a parade of dead white men.
Scott, it's a good question.
Well, I don't know. I guess I don't think of them as dead white men. I just think of them as human beings in search of the truth. And the great thing is when I think of it that way, I find that there are plenty of people who are not white or men who can join in that great pursuit of the truth. As I said, in terms of not just the Western tradition, I do like to bring in stuff from the Eastern tradition. I teach a course in Chinese philosophy, mostly dead yellow men. I don't know what the politically correct term for that would be. But there have been many great women philosophers as well. It's only really been recently that women have been given the kind of education or access to philosophy that has made that possible. But I'm just finishing a chapter in my new book on the great German philosopher Hannah Arendt, who actually was a student of Martin Heidegger, mentioned just not long ago, and one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. So like I said, my main thing is not to see them as this is the voice of men, but these are the voices of people looking for wisdom. As I mentioned earlier, like I've had students like Jillian, the nurse's aide who went on her great quest. She was going on a Socratic quest. It wasn't about being a male or a female quest. It was just trying to figure out the truth.
Well, you tell many stories in your book about your students. And I am struck by the fact that in the you have a number of non-traditional students, what we call non-traditional students in the class. And in some ways, it seems like they are ideal students of philosophy. I mean, you talk about a number of different times where you mentioned earlier the woman who'd lost her son through a decision that she had to make. And you talk about people who, you know, if you had just 1 year to live, how would you live that year? And you had a student who was in that exact situation. I've been diagnosed and I decided I wanted to further my education. I mean, you're dealing with people who are living philosophy.
That's right. And there's a great American philosopher, Stanley Cavell, who says philosophy is education for grownups. And I have kind of come to see that while I have many great 18 and 19 year old students who are really alive with philosophy, it's often the case that as we go through life, the kinds of questions that philosophy asks are made all the more poignant to us. When we're diagnosed with a terminal illness, the question of how should I live becomes incredibly poignant. And I've had those kinds of students who've been in that situation, or I've had students who've returned from war as veterans and who are asking questions about what's right and wrong, or about what's really meaningful and how can they relate to the world around them that often seems to be absorbed in meaningless activities. So life has a way of making us into philosophers at some point. So it's true that as we continue to go through this life, philosophy just becomes more and more important.
Well, and having that blend of students, that must be incredibly beneficial to all the students in the course to have an opportunity to. I'm 19 years old and I've never really been through anything difficult, and I'm across the room from somebody who really has been through the ringer.
Yeah. Or right now I have several students from Sudan, most of whom are here as refugees and who have experienced really tough things in war-torn Sudan. And so when we're raising questions about things like torture or justice or religious freedom, those are not just abstract questions to them. They're incredibly alive questions that have a life and death significance.
I'm talking with Scott Samuelson. He is a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City and author of the book The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone. Craig is on the line next in Davenport. Hi, Craig.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great show, and it's I've been waiting for this program, something like this, to come on for a very long time. I actually study philosophy at the University of Iowa, very much in the analytical style, logical positive, yada, yada, yada. I guess the question I have for Professor is, when I think of philosophy now, in terms of when I first started to do it, it's really about that problem solving. It's not about counting how many angels you can fit on the head of a pin or anything like that necessarily, but really about problem solving. And so my question to him was really about using and understanding logical fallacies for the average person, especially now that we're in a political season, not just taking someone's claim as necessarily true or factual, but being able to understand what a logical fallacy is and for when somebody makes a claim, and trying to delineate or disambiguate some of the statements being made and how important understanding logical fallacies are for the average person.
Yeah, well, I think that you're definitely onto something there. Right after this interview, I have to go teach a class called Basic Reasoning where we're studying the logical fallacies. So I'm with you in fighting that fight. A fallacy, for those who perhaps aren't familiar with the idea, is I like to call it imposter logic. It looks like good logic but is in fact bad logic.
Right.
The problem with these fallacies is that we often fall for them. They are often quite effective. And so the study of the fallacies kind of immunizes us against that kind of imposter logic. And yeah, I think it's crucially important. I mean, so the study of logic is important, but the study of philosophy more generally is, to me, a huge part of what good citizenship is all about. That to be a good citizen in part involves being able to engage with others in serious conversation to deliberate about what is really good and what's the right course for us as a country. And if we're going to do that in a serious way, we got to get past all the garbage that's out there. And, politicians commit fallacies all the time, not because they're stupid. Maybe some of them do because they're stupid, but most of them do it for more cynical reasons. They know that they're going to work, and they know that that level of discourse is the level that they're going to pitch things at to be effective. And so, insofar as we can study some philosophy, study some logic, it helps to raise that discourse a little bit.
Craig, thanks a lot for your call. We have another Craig on the line now, this one in Marion. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I graduated in 2008 from the University of Iowa and a BA in philosophy. Currently work in business, but it seems like the only time the philosophy ever comes up when I'm, sharing a beer with a friend. So it is a very perishable, skill, I'd call it. What are the ways I can kind of sharpen that skill as far as the logic and poignant conversations with peers of philosophy and stuff? Looking for recommendations there, I guess.
Well, can I ask you a question? Do you feel as if your training in philosophy has helped you at all in business?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I would, I'm 34, and I would say that I have a successful, career in business. I make six figures, and I think, a huge part of that is because I was a philosophy major, I was able to, day-to-day, it comes in, all the time, because, looking at problems analytically and how other things affect, other things, and how one decision about something affects, how we have to go forward on other things. And absolutely. I think it's a huge part of that. And to discredit that would be, a huge part of it.
Well, the reason why I ask is because I do think that studying things like philosophy and the liberal arts more generally can be hugely empowering, and we don't study them necessarily to get ahead at business, but they often give us the ability to. I wrote a piece at one point in the Wall Street Journal called "Would You Hire Socrates?" where I made the claim that the people who study things like philosophy often do go on to success in different fields. Though I said I always have my doubts that selling philosophy as a path to future riches is going to be effective. I've never had a student who's yet read Aristotle and said, "Wow, this is really going to pay dividends at IBM." But the funny thing was after I wrote this article, I got all of these letters from people who talked about how they'd studied Aristotle and gone on to do really well at IBM. And so I find that quite interesting. That goes to my point that when we have a good education, it empowers us wherever we are, wherever we find ourselves. But as to your initial question about where to find a kind of philosophical camaraderie, I just think that it can be found almost anywhere if you bother to look. I'm always interested to raise philosophical questions and see people kind of light up that a lot. They're thinking oftentimes of those kinds of questions themselves. But for me, I found the best kind of philosophical camaraderie through reading, that through hearing the voices of others and feeling like I can somehow be in dialogue with them.
Craig, thank you so much for your call. And I want to ask you, Scott, we talked earlier about how you ended up teaching at Kirkwood Community College, and clearly you found that was the kind of teaching that you wanted to do. Did you have an epiphany? Was there a moment where you thought, no, this, and you used the word destiny earlier, this is my destiny, this is where I should be?
Yeah, well, it actually came from someone asking me a philosophical question. It was at a New Year's party, and he asked everyone around. He said, "Are you fulfilling your destiny?" Which I thought was an incredibly rude question to be asking. And as someone trained in the philosophical tradition, I dodged it as best as I could. But I found myself for the next few days really wondering, am I fulfilling my destiny? And I had my doubts about it. But as I thought about it, all these moments flooded back of when I was involved in real philosophy with the various students that I had had. And I felt like, hey, this really is, you know, what philosophy is about. I did think in my mind, I went back to Socrates, my North Star. He was someone for whom philosophy was not just for some people or not just a solitary activity, but it was very much about going into everyday life and conversing with people and trying to pursue wisdom together. So, I guess I can say that I feel like I'm fulfilling my destiny in teaching where I am. I've also been doing some volunteer teaching at Oakdale Prison at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center. And that too has been really satisfying for me, and another way in which I see how philosophy can be really meaningful to people.
In receiving this prize, the Hyatt Prize in the Humanities, were you surprised that someone took notice of what you were doing?
Yeah, I was totally surprised. When I found out I won, I told them, surely there must be a better qualified candidate out there. but they assured me that they believed in what I was doing. The Dallas Institute, the group that awards it, I think shares some of my same deep commitments, a deep commitment to the liberal arts and a deep commitment to democracy and the idea that the goods of the liberal arts, things like philosophy, are empowering for us as a democratic nation. So, I'm very grateful for this. My Midwestern sensibilities, it's don't like being honored in this way, but I'm happy. I'll take it for now.
What do you think this might give you the opportunity to do?
Well, I don't know. I've been thinking about that question. I'm working on another book, and it has certainly given me a lot of impetus to try to finish that book. And I hope to do more teaching in the prison. I hope just to continue to stand up and raise my voice in favor of philosophy for everyone.
Scott Samuelson, thank you so much.
It's been my real pleasure. Thank you for this conversation.
Scott Samuelson is a professor of philosophy at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He is author of the book The Deepest Human Life, An Introduction to Philosophy for Everyone, and recently received the prestigious Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.